This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:07 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day.
Number 5.
No exams equals more pressure? Question mark.
This year, only 380,000 students sat for the SPM exams compared to 460,000 the previous year. So that's a 80,000 student deficit. According to Ila Jocelyn Mohan, president of the National Association of Private Educational Institutions.
So you might be thinking, why the huge decline? Well, at least one person has an answer or an idea. Rajasingham, co-founder of BAC Education Group, claims that the government's decision to abolish the UPSR and PT3 examinations is partly to blame. His argument is basically that without prior exposure to national exams, students are less prepared and feel greater pressure when sitting for SPM. And because they're not ready, they therefore drop out earlier.
Yeah, we've talked about this issue many times over, about checkpoint exams. Sarawak wants an answer to that. They've been given the chance to address that. So it's also worth noting, Lynn, that SPM candidacies look like in the past 3 years, right? So a study by an education activist group, Untuk Malaysia, found that a total of 71,000 students didn't show up for their SPM exams between the years 2019 and 2021. Now, two of those years were impacted by the COVID pandemic. And the NGO said that this had a direct impact on students who were unable to adapt to learning from home or for lack of a laptop or internet access.
So a number of things happened all at once, right? Because it was also around this time that the government decided to abolish the UPSR and PT3 exams. So whether this has been a good idea, whether this has been beneficial, is contentious. And to understand whether potentially this is a reason behind students choosing to skip SPM, we reached out to Shanaz Al-Sadat, chairperson of LeapEd Services.
A reduction of the SPM candidates this year is really no surprise, I think, to people who know the landscape that this is an expected trend post-pandemic. The students supposed to take SPM this year, 2024, probably in Standard 6 in 2020. So factually, it's correct that they are the batch that miss out in terms of having UPSR PT3 as the assessments that will help them. The main cause is that a lot of the students, when they came back post-pandemic, they are struggling to catch up. There's actually a learning loss situation. And 60% of the students are feeling that they are not supported by the teachers in the school. So they were 16 maybe at this point. And rather than, you know, spending another couple of years not catching up, failing the exams, they probably have dropped out and not going to school. And this is, I think, a real issue for Malaysia, because you are going to have plenty of unskilled workers coming out from this batch.
So she also brought up the recent study has shown about students disengaging from learning.
Really, the data that's coming back from students, one is they need motivation because they feel the education system is not relevant to them. They, you know, can spend 2 years in school or 3 years in university, they're still not going to get the right jobs. They are finding that the environment in the school are not bringing out their potential, and they feel that they can actually be YouTuber and you know, influencers, and that will be fine. And teachers, unfortunately, are struggling with a wide variant in terms of the top and the bottom due to the learning losses issues, and thus they are only able to maybe cater to the middle ground. And with all these factors all rolling it in, these are why there are less students taking SPM.
That was Shanaz Al-Sadat, chairperson of LeapEd Services. If you'd like to weigh in on whether you agree that fewer checkpoint exams before SPM means that students are finding it kind of hard to cope when they get there, you can call 7733 2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number 4.
Continuing our countdown to the biggest story of the day, the Unity government has announced their candidate for the Kuala Kubu Baru by-elections.
Right. So DAP's Pang Sok Tao, an aide to Housing and Local Government Minister Nga Kor Ming, has been selected to stand. It said that she was picked from a list of a list consisting entirely of women. The announcement for the candidacy was made by DAP Secretary General Anthony Lok last night.
Sharad, at this point, I would like to interrupt and ask whether you would like to say the word that we always say about by-elections. We have a choice. We could call it a bellwether. We could call it a referendum. These are the words that people use about by-elections.
Well, interestingly enough, just a couple of minutes ago, Malaysia Kini published an article where Selangor past leaders said that the government of Selangor could fall if the unity government candidate doesn't win. So I don't know if that's an argument to support the unity government candidate or, in fact, to support the PN candidate.
But I think it does reflect the kind of stakes that we tend to talk about or that tend to come up around this time whenever there is any sort of by-election. So there has, of course, because of all this, because of the stakes, been a heavy amount of speculation about Pakatan Harapan's strategy when it comes to choosing their candidate. Just last week, Free Malaysia Today talked about how hinted that Pakatan would field a popular local councillor who is Malay because of KKB's demographics. As of now, Malays comprise 50% of the electorate there, Chinese people at 30%, Indians at 18%.
Yeah, so public sentiments, or rather public statements from Perikatan, however, suggest that both Gerakan and Bersatu want a candidate of their choice. Even former DAP stalwart P. Ramasamy has weighed in, calling on Perikatan to place an ethnic Indian candidate.
So, to get a better understanding of the choices at hand and their repercussions, we reached out to Dr. Shaza Shukri, Associate Professor of Political Science from IIUM.
Okay, I think there were a lot of talks previously on whether the unity government would propose a Malay candidate, because there were a lot of data sharing about the changing demography of KKB, how Malay voters are on the rise. But I think they've come to realize that the unity government cannot rely so much on the Malay voters, so it doesn't make sense to try to win over the specific demographic with the potential of losing the support that they've had for years previously. So I think the strategy is that try to maintain the support and the votes from those who already support Pakatan Harapan, the DAP, and hopefully some BN voters as well, rather than trying to win over new voters.
So she also talked to us about Perikatan's possible strategy in their nomination for the by-elections.
In response to this, Perikatan Nasional might propose a Malay candidate instead of someone from Gerakan, because I think that is their best bet. And again, that has been their base. If they propose someone from Gerakan that is non-Malay, the chances is quite difficult for them to campaign in the way of what they, meaning Perikatan Nasional, has always championed, which is more on protecting, defending Malays. So I think that might be how they're going to go into it now.
That was Dr. Shaza Shukri, Associate Professor of Political Science from IIUM. If you have thoughts about the KKB by-elections and the choices that the various parties are making or might make, you can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We will be continuing our countdown to the biggest story of the day on Top 5 at 5 after this. So keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5:17 and this is Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. Story 5 was about how abolishing national exams before SPM may be leading to more dropouts at the SPM level. Story 4 was about DAP's candidate for the KKB by-elections. And now we're moving on.
Number 3.
Malaysia, or rather a large case to do with the smuggling of rhino horns.
Yeah, so two men pleaded not guilty, and therefore there's going to be a trial at the Sepang Sessions Court yesterday for the illegal possession of 50 rhinoceros horns. Now, Traffic Southeast Asia, an NGO that focuses on trade in wild species, noted that this case marked one of Malaysia's largest rhino horn seizures, with only one case having been prosecuted so far.
This is significant for a number of reasons. We have, I think, been identified for a very long time now as a hub for the trafficking of animals and parts. And so I think kind of having it out there, having it be something that is a significant court case matters, right? Because otherwise, when we look at the entire ecosystem of what happens to endangered animals and the entire kind of business structure around it, it can be very easy, I think, sometimes to absolve ourselves.
Yeah. So if you have the laws, the next step is you need to have successful prosecutions, right? Otherwise, the law kind of just sits on the books, right?
Yeah.
And then the question is enforcement, they're collecting the right evidence? If they take it to court, can they successfully prosecute those individuals? Otherwise, we also have another problem. People are brought to court, but then, let off the hook. So this is a kind of filling out of what I think is an aspiration not to be a hub for the trafficking of endangered animals.
So let's talk about those laws, right? Because if we start with the horns, they're from two types of endangered rhinoceros from African countries, the square-lipped rhinoceros and the black rhinoceros. And because they're classified as fully protected species under the Wildlife Conservation Act 2010, both men in this case were charged under Section 68(1)(b) of the Act, which carries a maximum fine of 100,000 ringgit and a prison sentence of up to 3 years.
Now, to understand the significance of this case, we reached out to Elizabeth John, Communications Manager of Traffic Southeast Asia.
Like several other countries in Southeast Asia, Malaysia is no stranger to the trafficking of African rhino horns into Asia. The country has made several confiscations of rhino horns in past years, but there were no arrests and prosecutions connected to those cases. So the case currently in court is very significant, because it is the first time anyone has been arrested and tried for a rhino horn-related offence in Malaysia. It will help enforcement agencies and investigators better understand how the rhino horns are being smuggled through the country, and a strong conviction will show Malaysia's commitment to tackling this crime. This case is also one to watch, because one of the 50 rhino horns seized here is from the black rhino, which is classified as critically endangered.
That was Elizabeth John, Communications Manager of Traffic Southeast Asia. Let us know if you have thoughts. As always, the number to call, 7733 2900. You can send a voice note or WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number two.
Almost at the top of our countdown to the biggest story of the day on Top 5 at 5, a controversial professor has downplayed Malaysia's political relevance and actually gone further than that, called us a number of things. But is it for the wrong reasons?
Yeah, so on Tuesday, Bruce Gilley, a professor of political science from Portland State University, delivered a talk about Malaysia's potential to become an active middle power. Now, a quote from the talk was posted on X by Bruce himself. He said, and I quote, "A country whose political leaders advocate a second Holocaust against the Jewish people will never be a serious player in world affairs and will certainly never be a friend or partner of the United States of America."
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack in that statement, I think, and there are a number of ways that you could approach the story. We could talk about academic freedom. We could talk about the responses that this has gotten. We could talk about Bruce Gilley's GoFundMe, which we will do in a little bit.
And then recent threats against academics in University of Malaya.
In University of Malaya, that's right. So there are many kind of aspects that we could draw out. But before that, we wanted to dwell a little bit on his original proposition that essentially if Malaysia wants to be considered politically relevant as a middle power, that it needs to be aligned with Israel. So, or at least that's the kind of broad argument. So we reached out to Bun Negara, director and senior fellow of the BRI caucus and honorary fellow at the Perak Academy, for his take.
Now, for countries like Malaysia, it is far more important to become a fully developed country. That's quite different from being a middle power or whatever power. Whether any country is a middle power or not, it's not up to the views of any particular country or individual like Bruce Gilley. It will depend on the combination of vital factors such as the three R's, you know, resources, responsibilities, and righteous policies. It also depends on a country's contribution to the international community, its performance in the economy, diplomacy, and social development, as well as its credibility at home and abroad. Now, let's not forget that the second Holocaust, which Gili mentioned, is already here. It is practiced by Zionist Israel on the Muslim, Christian, and other Palestinian communities of Gaza. That is a fact. It is ridiculous for anyone to argue that Malaysia will not make it as a middle power if it fails to side with Israel and its chief sponsor, the US.
That was Budnagar, Director and Senior Fellow of the BRI Caucus and Honorary Fellow of Pera Academy. Now, coming back to the controversy, because it's really getting very heated at the point. At this point, Bruce has apparently was apparently referring to Agricultural Minister Matsabu, who said that, and I quote, "Israel will soon disappear," in a rally which Bruce shared, for which Bruce shared a TikTok in a subsequent post. Now, he also highlighted Mate's reputation for calling for the killing of Jews, apparently, as well as the common usage of the phrase "from the river to the sea" and "Israel Chua" in local media.
So that was the post that caught the attention of Muda's acting president, Amira Aisha Abdulaziz, who said that it was misleading and unacceptable. That raised the concern of the higher education minister, Dr. Sri Dr. Zamri Abdul Kadeh, who ordered all programs and activities involving Bruce to be cancelled. Both UM and the ministry are investigating the issue. But like you said, Sharad, there's been a significant amount of fallout, right? I mean, I think that ordering the cancellation and so on is, in fact, fallout there as well. But the original post by that sparked all this has been deleted. Bruce has also now left what he calls this Islamo-fascist state. He set up a GoFundMe page to recover his travel costs. He has raised, as of last check, $295 US of his $2,346 goal. And then perhaps even, well, not perhaps, and then more importantly, as you pointed out, Sharad, there are people at UM who, as a result of this, are now also getting harassed.
Yeah, they're getting doxed. I don't think this is the correct use of the word expression, because what's happened is people are taking images of those who head the particular department. They're putting it on Twitter. They're getting a lot of hate speech. A lot of hate directed at them and threats. And so this is the other thing, right? On one hand, we mock somebody like Bruce for talking about the country, characterizing us as an Islamo-fascist state, but then people...
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh. It's just, it's such an extreme position
to take. Yeah, you know, he's what they call self-dramatizing, you know, a kind of academic from, I looked up this ranking of Portland State University. It's not very high. Anyway, the point is that, you know, if we're going to prove him wrong, then surely we shouldn't be now going on a witch hunt and also threatening our own academics for hosting him.
Well, MZ says, "Why do we as Malaysians always think we're the centre of the world? Speak to many Westerners and they think we're still living on trees. As long as we harp on trivial issues and get triggered left, right and centre for the smallest of issues, we have no right to be taken seriously by the global community." MZ, I agree so firmly with 50% of what you're saying. And then the other 50%, I really don't.
Yeah, well, see, MZ, the problem is the issue of Gaza, the issue of Palestine, the issue of the conduct of nation states like ours, small to middle size, in this present international scenario is very important. It's not a trivial matter. And so taking the side of Palestinians, as South Africa has done, as Brazil has done, as Ecuador has done, is not to be on the wrong side of history. It is, in fact, to work against America's interest in the Middle East, that's for sure. But then what's the right position to take?
Yeah, so I think that there is a difference between looking at the country's position, which, as you rightly point out, Sharad, is on the side of Palestine. And then the other thing is the way in which we sometimes act up. And frankly, we act up. If you talk about doxing people, if you're talking about, you know, kind of leaving a string of comments on, say, Bruce Gilley's Twitter, like those things, I agree with you, aren't helpful. They can make us look a certain way. But I don't think that that in and of itself means that the international community shouldn't take us seriously. I would also say that if Westerners think we live on trees, that's their problem.
Indeed it is.
just simply put.
Because I loved my tree house as a child, that I can't say I still live in one.
Keep those thoughts coming, whether it is about, well, Bruce Gilley, about rhino horns, or for that matter, the SPM. You can call, send us a voice note or WhatsApp. You can also, of course, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5:38 and this is Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. And I'm sure everyone's waiting with bated breath. That's what we expect anyway. So if you want a quick recap before we hit the top story. Story 5, why are people dropping out pre-SPM? Story 4, DAP's candidate for the KKB by-elections. Story 3, the first open trial on the smuggling of rhino horns. And story 2, the controversy surrounding an American professor who spoke at UN.
Number 1.
And that brings us to the ongoing Supermax family saga. Now, this is a... I don't know if I would call it a convoluted story. There are a number of players. There is a plane.
And there's that private jet is actually very important.
The private jet is as important a player as anybody else, yes. So basically, maybe we start with a resignation. So Supermax Corp announced that Cecile Jacqueline Tai had resigned as non-executive director after a series of disagreements with the board. Now, she is the eldest daughter of the executive chairman, Stanley Tai, and his wife, Cheryl Tan, who founded the company in 1987 and control a 38.37% stake in the group.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a fascinating story of a family-run business, right? And there's even a nephew in the story, believe it or not. But, you know, what I think it really speaks to is the changing nature of the Malaysian economy, because one of the things, of course, is that their fortunes have been in decline because of China's rapid domination of the rubber glove industry globally. And at the same time, you know, you have this whole idea behind it of succession of, you know, of the people who made the company now bring their children in and the children have to take over. But what happens when parents and children disagree? In this case, what happens when husband and wife disagree too?
So we're going to be getting into the nitty-gritty of this. Joining us to do that is our guest, Emmanuel Samarathisa, who is a journalist and founder of The Malaysianist. Emmanuel, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Lynn and Sherrod. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
So, okay, the latest development in what the media has dubbed the Supermax Tai family saga pits husband Tan Sri Stanley Tai against his wife. Is this a story that you find interesting?
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. I mean, the Supermax family is one of the more colorful, you know, Chinese Malaysian business families. I mean, even among glove makers, usually, you know, glove makers, many of them are run by Chinese businesses. But they are very disciplined. You know, you only hear about them if there's a merger, acquisition, or even like, you know, labor-related abuses, like what we have seen, you know, during the COVID period. But aside from them, they are very just quiet. But this one, no, Supermax seems to be kind of the exception.
Yeah, so, okay, let's talk a little bit. I think a lot of us perhaps don't understand or know of these families and how they built their wealth, right? So maybe we could begin there. Could you give us a kind of brief chronology of Stanley Tai and the Supermax company, which, as we mentioned earlier, was formed in 1987?
All right, so I'll take it from there. So basically, Stanley, you know, he began by trading latex gloves in 1987, and he's paid up capital, the company that his paid up capital then was only 2 ringgit at that time. And so, you know, because when you are trading, you know, gloves, margins were very low. So he decided to go for high volume, you know, to gain more profit. And back then he only had his wife, you know, Cheryl, and a secretary to assist him. So it was very lean, very small company. He worked really long hours, you know, he had to entertain a lot of clients. He even, I think there was one time where he opted for an overnight train instead of staying at a hotel. So he was very frugal. He was, you know, he was just very determined, and he made his first million 2 years later at 29 years old. And it's only then, I think in 1989, where he moved into manufacturing gloves. That was a joint venture. But in 1990, that's where he set up his own plant, And then 7 years later, I think around 1997, he had about 3 wholly owned manufacturing plants. And then in 2003, Supermax listed on the Bursa Malaysia's main market. And then from there, it just started, expanding capacity. I think somewhere along the line, they diversified into contact lenses and so on. So that's sort of like a brief idea of how Supermax came to be.
Now, if we look at one of the things that kind of tipped it over, the proposed purchase of a 210 million ringgit private jet apparently was the last straw for daughter Cecile, who resigned from the board. And she wrote a scathing open letter in which she makes some serious charges against the governance of the company. Can you kind of assess her allegations?
Yeah, I mean, basically she claimed that, there was some governance issues there, that it's not worth, spending money on the jet, because the jet was on the company, or was one of the books of the subsidiaries, right? And then she was, quote-unquote, silenced and bullied, in her own words, right, from other board members, including her father. And then she resigned because she felt, she had to do the right thing. But now, she was not the only daughter to claim this. Stanley's younger daughter, or Cecile's younger sister, Aurelia, also actually opposed the purchase of the jet. So the two daughters actually opposed it, and two daughters also made similar claims of, being oppressed, being persecuted for speaking out against the father. But the company has, sort of denied, all allegations.
Now, so one of the things in the timeline of the saga was a kind of boardroom shakeup, I believe that's the right expression, which saw the entry of nephew C.K. Tan. Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about him and what this move signaled about family dynamics?
Well, I don't have a lot of insight into C.K. Tan, but basically the dynamics are just pretty much simple, right? That Stanley wants to retain, control of the company, and he wants to be in charge. Because it's basically, Supermax basically his baby, right? If you were to go back earlier to how he built the company. And so he wants to be in charge, and he just wants to, he doesn't want, my opinion is that he doesn't want stiff opposition. And I remember even back then when I covered him in 2019, and 2019, some of us were surprised he was there, because this was when he was charged earlier for insider trading, and he was appealing the conviction. But so even while he was appealing, he still wanted to be seen, front and center. So that's always been him, That's him. Just wants to be in charge.
So the thing is that the latest turn in this squabble between Stanley and Cheryl is over the dissolution of Supermax Holdings Sendirian Berhad. Cheryl wants it dissolved, Stanley doesn't, saying that SHSB was set up to establish a family trust for their 3 children and their future generations. What does this say about succession planning?
I just think that if you were to take the SHSB context, you really have to wind the clock back to 2014. Now, 2014 was a very interesting year for Stanley and Cheryl, because both of them were charged with insider trading. 2017, they were convicted, sentenced to 5 years prison, and they were fined 5 million. Then they appealed the decision. So it was during this time, and so in 2018, that's where they decided to move their shares. They directly held shares, and they moved it into SHSB, as a trust, right? Because 2018 was the period where they were appealing this decision. So it was a kind of an uncertain time for both of them, right? And then it was only, I think, in 2020 where both the decision, I mean, the sorry, where 2 things happened in 2020. The first thing was that the charges, I mean, the prison sentence was overturned. And then the regulators, Bursa, I think the SC, approved of that transferring of shares into SHSB. So that is the context of SHSB, actually.
Okay, so but to come back to the question of succession plan, because that's Stanley's overt reason for wanting to hold on. I mean, is there any reason, from a business point of view, for a dissolution or against a dissolution?
I really don't, because Supermax in general is a family-run company, right? And the family owns, Stanley and Cheryl together collectively owns about 40%+ of the company. So I guess for Stanley, he during that time, he felt that by putting it into a family trust, it would keep the company safe within the family's hands, in case things did not pan out accordingly. So that's as much as we have with Supermax. You know, it's not the kind of succession that we are seeing with, for example, a glove maker like Harta Lega, where the son is now running the business, and there was a proper succession plan where the son was climbing up the ranks, and then he started to take charge of things. He was, you know, the face of Harta Lega during press conferences, analyst briefings, and so on. So it's very, very different.
I think I'd also like to maybe take a step back, right? Because part of the backdrop to this whole thing is the decline of Supermax's fortunes, several years of losses, the rise of China, of course, as a major competitor on price in the rubber glove space. What does this tell us about the pressures that exist on local glove manufacturers?
See, I think they're two separate issues, right? So the family drama and the decline in Supermax's fortunes, they are just separate, because if they are one and the same, then you would definitely see this sort of squabbling, these tiffs happening among other Chinese-owned glove makers, right? But we don't see that. So it's kind of unique to Supermax, right? If you look at the macro level, overcapacity, oversupply, depressed glove prices, these things have been a common issue in the industry for a while. Analysts are looking at probably perhaps 2026 for demand supply to reach equilibrium. But I think the reason that we all honed in on this is because of COVID-19. I mean, during the pandemic, these tycoons made a killing, when it comes to earnings and profits, share prices like just shot up. I'll just give you a picture. Stanley's net worth shot up, I think, to US $1.1 billion in 2021. According to Forbes, right? And then in 2022, it just dropped to, US 340 million. So it's a huge drop there. So everybody, is feeling, everybody in the glove space is feeling the pinch. But it's not exactly a unique phenomenon.
Right, so let's come back to the family drama, because I guess that's the more a juicy one. But broadly speaking, what does the Supermax saga tell us about the challenges of family-owned businesses of this size?
Well, family feuds, they're not only confined to Supermax, right? It just tells us that at the end of the day, we're all humans, and, when you run a family business, personal life, public life, and private life, there seems somehow to be no separation, right? So things just boil over into the public sphere. The Chinese businesses, they have this thing called the third generation curse, that kind of myth going along. But, for Supermax, they are not even in the third generation. Stanley is like perhaps the first, I guess, the first guy to do in his family to do this. But, but we do see these episodes from time to time. I think a couple of years ago, we saw the younger Genting generation, duking it out over the inheritance and estate, but that also has been settled. So we have some of these things creeping up from time to time. But I guess if you're looking at it in today's day and age, right, you're looking at it from an investor's point of view, you're going to look at it probably to ask whether or not some of these businesses are worth backing, because they like, for example, for Supermax, it has been glove making all these years. You have a very strong patriarch. So sometimes investors' interest, the family's interest may not align, accordingly. But the good news here, or the takeaway here, is that while we enjoy the popcorn, munching popcorn and watching this thing just make the headlines, the good news is that at least this is just purely a family business, and it's not a GLIC investee company. Some GLICs have family businesses as their investee companies through a very interesting shareholding structure. So that part, if the family business is such, then of course, I guess it's worrying, but because it involves public institutions. But in this case, no, it's just a pure family business. And yeah, that's about it, really.
Emmanuel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Emmanuel Samarathisa, journalist and founder of The Malaysianist, taking us through the twists and turns of the Supermax family saga. If you would like to send a thought or a message, you can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note, or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
It is 5:53 and you are listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod. Just a recap of the five stories today. We started off by looking at a claim that the reason why SPM numbers have dropped is because of the UPSI and PT3 not preparing students to get there. We also talked about the candidate for the Kuala Kubu Baru by-elections, about rhino horn smuggling and a court case, a trial to do with that, as well as a professor who is calling Malaysia an Islamo-fascist state or anti-Semitic as part of his...
as part of his
appearance here, I guess. And more seriously, saying that this kind of undermines our attempts to be a strong middle player, middle power. And then, of course, we talked about Supermax. So if you'd like to share those thoughts, you can call, send us a voice note or WhatsApp and tweet us as well. Let's start with the issue of the SPM, because we've gotten a number of thoughts on that, including a voice note from John.
Hi there, I'm John, and I'm responding on the reason why students are dropping out before SPM. I think it's because some students are forced to get into the working force to help raise money and sustain their family. Also, back then when I was a school student myself, a lot of people usually say that employers are looking for experience instead of your academic results. And your experience is the key to help you climb up the ladder in the industry. For example, the filmmaking one, experience is usually prioritized compared to academics. All right, that's all. Thank you.
Thanks, John. I think that that's a very interesting point.
Yeah, definitely. I think the market does demand this, and sometimes very unfairly. If you're a new entrant to the market, what kind of experience are you going to get unless somebody hires you, right?
Yeah, and then beyond that, there's also the pressure that young people might feel to help support the family. This is something that we've talked about a fair amount. It's also something that we heard explicitly discussed during the pandemic, because then families were really kind of struggling financially and there were people who felt that they had to do that.
Yeah, exactly. But this one attendant problem with not doing your SPM. Now, if you don't have a UPSR and you don't have any other certificate,
that's right, yeah,
you leave the school system with essentially no checkpoint certificate, right? Nothing to say that you've had all these years except maybe your school transcripts. So this is a bit of a problem, right? Because you were always asked in a form, what is your highest qualification?
That's right. So I think while you might want experience in order to work, at some point, if you want to return to school or if you want to gain access to... I think what I'm getting at is you hit a wall or you hit a ceiling without certain qualifications. Others are pointing out Sarah saying, this is interesting. Both Sarah and Lewis use the word disengage. So Sarah says, I believe that students disengage from sitting for the SPM exam because of a lack of interest where they don't find subjects relevant to them, academic pressure from parents and students dealing with personal problems like mental health issues or family problems.
Yeah, I mean, there are tremendous, I think, pressures on students these days, Sarah, and I can't imagine what they are. I mean, they were there for me, 30 years ago. I think it's, in fact, in many ways, it's doubled down. I don't know if the removal of the exams were and this continual assessment process was actually supposed to relieve those pressures. They have unintended consequences, unfortunately.
Lewis is also pointing to the fact that student interests might lie elsewhere and not everybody is academically inclined. Now, if we look at the messages that have come in on the subject of Bruce Gilley, Hong on X says, he's pro-colonialism. Why would UM invite a pro-colonial professor to give a talk here? Anthony, meanwhile, says, I think this is the first time I've struggled with the freedom of speech discourse. First time. I think ultimately where I land is, say if there's a hypothetical situation where the authorities went after Bruce and arrested him, I would be firmly against that. If they use sedition, I would be against it. But I think public outrage in the global south against someone who's pro-colonialism and pro-Zionist is justified. I'm so proud that every single political party in Malaysia, from PSM all the way to pass, stand firmly behind Palestine. James Baldwin once said, we can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist.
Anthony, I agree with you. You know, this is one of those instances where I think pro-freedom speech advocates or free speech advocates will have a problem because they might not agree with the content. And this is always the issue, right? If you're rooting for your own side and for the people that you like and align to politically, then free speech is a very easy argument to make. It's much more difficult to make the argument for people you don't agree with.
Yeah, I think for me, another part of it is actually what the function of a speech in a university is supposed to do, because it should... Not always, but I think that there is space for provocative ideas. There should be space for provocative ideas that you deeply disagree with. This is part and parcel of finding out what you deeply disagree with. If you don't come up against it, then it's always in the abstract and it doesn't have that much meaning. So I don't know that I necessarily agree that invitations to speak need only be extended to people who say things that you are aligned to. Having said that, if there are... So basically, is being pro-colonialist hate speech? So I think that those are the kinds of things that we maybe need to get into. Anyway, thank you everybody for getting in touch. So keep it here, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.